Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Tuesday afternoon. Getting kind of a late start, so I want to jump right in. John Najarian, co-founder of Option Monster, is on the phone line, and you can follow him on Twitter at Option Monster. John, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Great to be with you, sir.
Let's start with some terminology. And I know the Dow is down a bit today, but it's been on a little bit of a run. Goldman Sachs talking about that yesterday, and they referred to it, or others were referring to it, this little rally we're having, as a short covering. Do you think that's where we are? But can you start just by explaining what that is?
Well, short covering is when people who have sold the market or a given stock in hopes of buying it back at a cheaper price. So in other words, if they sell the S&P when it trades through 2000, which it did last week and held that this week, then they hope to buy it back as it falls perhaps to 1975 or some such level. And they make a profit the same way a long buyer of the market would make a profit if the market went higher. When those short sellers get squeezed, to Stephen's point, that's what drives the market higher. Even if there's not any fundamental reason, it could just be that the short sellers, those who, again, who sold the market in hopes of buying it back cheaper, are seeing losses pile up day after day. So a five-day rally like we just had leading in, that can catch a lot of people on the short side.
So those of us who've been outside dancing in the streets, better coins back in the house.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly right.
Tell me what's going on at United Airlines, UAL, with this insurgents now, these shareholders trying to bring in former Continental CEO Gordon Bethune, put him on the board. What's up there?
Yeah, well, he's very highly thought of in the airline industry, perhaps one of the most highly thought of executives, has not been active for the last couple of years except in board service. But United's had a host of problems. I mean, obviously, Munoz has had health issues, of course, after that heart attack. That's not
poor guy's trying to come back on Monday, isn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. But the other folks are looking at things like that problem with the Port Authority of New Jersey and New York, and whether or not gates were offered to United for perhaps a sweetheart deal on certain transportation of somebody who worked at the Port Authority's wife to and from their vacation home.
That's all the Chris Christie stuff, right?
Yeah, and as much as it hurts Chris Christie, he can't run again. But the board that's there has been there during all these problems. If they're scandals, then call them scandals as well. And people are looking for a little clearing of the air, and that's why Mr. Bethune, who, as I say, very highly thought of, is making that serious bid for that proxy fight for the board.
Well, we watch you on CNBC, and Bethune was on CNBC earlier today referring to the United board, the United Continental board, as having a country club atmosphere. So clearly, if this happens, first of all, is it going to happen? And if it does, it's going to come with quite a bit of friction.
It would, but overall, I bet investors would prefer it. Anytime a board gets accused of being lax or a country club, as has been accused, as you say, by Mr. Bethune, then that's not a positive. Institutional investors that operate with most of the money invested in these big companies don't like to hear that. They'd much rather hear that the board is very responsive to problems and very willing and quick to correct them. So that's what Mr. Bethune more or less is offering, is his leadership, not to run the company, but to perhaps run a more effective board. And that's what he's hoping to do with this move that he's made now.
All right, who's moving on Wall Street? I see Dick's Sporting Goods, not so good with their report. Urban Outfitters, a much different story.
Right. Dick's Sporting Goods, there was really nothing good in that report. And yet, after trading all the way down to $41.85, or about $42 a share, let's say, it has come launching all the way back. If you asked me, Stephen, I would say, number one, it was the screaming buy down there, not only because it's come back, but because of the Sport Authority and the bankruptcy filing that's gone on there. They're going to close a ton of stores. I don't ever root for that, of course, but that you have to analyze it and say, who's that good for? It's good for Dick's Sporting Goods, which has to be the largest retailer of sporting goods, just lost one of its biggest competitors.
You know, and I want to get to your stock tip, but just very quickly, when I was growing up, it seems like the sporting goods stores were the cheaper stores. You would go there to save a little money sometimes. And now, I mean, I think of Dick's and Sports Authority, when it comes to clothing, is almost a high-end store.
Yep, it is. And the margins are high-end, too. Problem is, if you pick the wrong stuff to go on the floor, that apparently Sports Authority had overextended itself in that regard, and they're stuck with it. They got to discount it heavily, just like many retailers did around Christmas, and they were operating on such a razor-thin edge, Sports Authority, that is, that certainly is helping Dick's Sporting Goods today and probably for the foreseeable future.
I'll tell you, when I was buying my gym shorts at Saukeld Sports in Kankakee, Illinois, I was not getting ripped off, but that was a long time ago. Give me a tip.
Well, those shorts weren't $40
no,
like they are now.
No, they weren't, in fact, and I still have them. I still have them. I still wear them around. I'll send you a picture.
All right.
No, you don't want that. Do you have an eye,
by the way, on Fitbit today.
Fitbit, okay.
The reason is that's exactly one of those items that they sell at Dick's or Sports Authority. These guys, the stock has just been decimated after earnings last week, and now people are betting maybe that there's some M&A activity that might happen with a Nike or with an Under Armour. They've also got a conference tomorrow, the Cowen Healthcare Conference, and they're one of the people presenting at that conference. Very strong activity in that stock
today. All right, we'll watch that. John Najarian, thanks very much for joining us on this Tuesday.
Always. Thank you, Steve.
It's 12:23. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. And I want to welcome to the studio Justin Doggett, who has come from KyotoStyleCoffee.com, and he's come bearing gifts as well. Justin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
All right, come right up to that microphone. And so this is, tell me a little bit about your story. You were familiar with this Kyoto style coffee, mm-hmm. started making it on your own, right? How long ago?
So I started in 2013. Basically, I found out about Kyoto style coffee. This is back before it really became more well known on the internet.
Right.
So you just hear about it in forums, on different websites. So I found one place in Chicago that actually sold it, went and tried it. It wasn't that great, but I liked the style. It was very different. So I said, you know what? I'm going to try to make this at home.
And so you did?
Yes.
And so what is involved in making it? Why is it different? It's cold coffee.
Yes.
And so, what is it that makes it different?
So basically, it's brewed using cold water that you put into a reservoir. So basically, if you can imagine a tower that looks like a tall hourglass, you put water in the top and it has a nozzle that drips one drop of water at a time over the grounds of coffee.
Uh-huh.
That water travels through and then after doing an extraction, it becomes a strong coffee at the bottom.
Okay. And then so you started making it, started enjoying it, giving it to your friends.
Exactly.
And they said, here, take money for this.
Yeah. So let me back up and say, the machines that make this usually cost $300. It's made of glass and wood. And when I started making it at home, I went to the Science Surplus store to get like a separatory funnel and a lab stand to put together the components of
it
for like $75 instead.
No kidding.
So yeah,
maybe you should sell the machines.
Yeah, maybe. But I started off because I used to work for Metropolis Coffee Company before mm-hmm. this. I was the trainer. And one of the perks of working there was you get free beans. So it was perfect because I could just experiment at home with my machine. And I was making so much coffee that I had to do something with it. So I just started giving it away. And slowly my friends started forcing me to take their money because I was just giving them so much coffee.
And so then when did it occur to you that maybe you would turn this into your own business?
Last year.
Right.
Last
and year. So and you say on your website that it's a strong, thick coffee.
Yes.
That might not be for everyone.
It might not be for everyone. I mean, if you like dark chocolate, stout beers, cognac, things like that, it has that sort of profile.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like those things, it will work for you. But also the caffeine kick is so strong that you might get kind of dizzy if you drink too much of
really?
It.
Really? So yeah. I have to say that I drink a lot of coffee,
right.
And I tell people that I don't notice the caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
Will I notice the caffeine on yours?
Oh, yeah.
And also, I have to say, the cold coffee I drink is the coffee that I buy in the morning and don't finish until the afternoon.
Where do you usually get it from?
Starbucks or any machine that sells coffee for a quarter.
Why don't you finish it? I'm curious. Cause that's like one of those... questions I always have. I see like an unfinished coffee and I'm, you know, as a person who sells coffee,
right,
I'm like, oh, it would break my heart if I saw like my coffee unfinished somewhere.
Well, here's the thing. It's not that I don't enjoy it. I enjoy it all day long for a longer time.
Uh-huh.
So I don't mind when it's cold. All right. I'm holding a cup of yours now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to take a sip of
okay.
this, right?
Brace
yourself. Just a sip?
Yeah. Yeah. The typical serving size is 4 ounces. It's a concentrate.
Yeah.
And then from there, you can add milk or water to it to make a full-size drink out of it.
Well, you like it black.
I like it straight. Yeah.
Right.
Just straight black.
And so, well, it's very nice. Thank you. It
yeah.
is. It's almost like a Guinness.
Exactly. That's why yeah. stout beer, you know, that's one of the flavor notes.
And so you talked about how you make it. It takes mm-hmm. a long time.
Yes. So it's actually funny because when I started off, it was a little home machine that would sit on my desk. And now it's grown to about the size of me. And in that process, I've been able to cut the time that it takes to make it.
How much can you make in a day?
So I can make, basically, I started off in 12 hours being able to make 2 gallons of it. Now I can make twice as much in 6 hours.
So, Justin, that's hard to make a lot of money if you're not making a lot of coffee.
Yes. Yes. It's a labor of love right now.
It is, but you hope yeah. to expand maybe?
I hope so, yeah.
Right, go back yeah. to the Science Surplus store.
Yeah, if I keep doing the right thing, I mean, people are asking me for it, and that's always a good sign.
Right,
you know,
that's exactly.
People come up to me and say, do you have coffee?
I don't want to use an organic pun when it comes to coffee, but if something grows organically like
yes.
that, that's the best way to do
yes.
it. All right, it's Kyoto Black, and it's KyotoStyleCoffee.com. Justin Doggett, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
All right, good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, 720 WGN. Suzanne Muchen is in the studio. She's the co-host of The Big Payoff on WGNplus.com. Suzanne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Steve.
I've been promising all afternoon that you would take us into the girls' lounge
yeah.
when you got here. And so let's go.
Let me be your guide.
So this is a wild story to
me. It's a wild story. And, you know, we should get to the heart of it quickly so we can talk about what we think about it. So Shelley Zales is a Hollywood executive, notices that when she goes to conferences, you know, these big South by Southwest or
Davos,
big major conferences, that the networking opportunities and the physical spaces that they're taking place in are very male. Whether that means they're at a bar or sometimes obviously there are golf outings or cigar smoking experiences. And she decides to put up something called a girls' lounge.
Right.
At these events, sometimes it's a pop-up environment where, you know, it's literally a built environment. Sometimes it's at a penthouse of a hotel. But the idea here is it's physically very female. The food is female. The music is more catering to women.
You know, it's so female that I would get in trouble if I did it, right? Pink pillows, manicures, hey, you're good enough coach in the back room.
Absolutely.
Right? If a guy does that, that's trouble.
Meaning if a guy was the founder of that?
Exactly.
Oh, you'd get
yeah.
killed. Slaughtered.
Right, but not Shelley. So Shelley's got
not
this.
Not Shelley. So she comes up with this idea and there's a great story of a guy who walks into the girls' lounge because he's having a meeting with another executive and they can't find a place to sit. And he walks in and he sees a bunch of women in robes with towels on their head because part of the girls' lounge is sort of touch up and makeup and all this. And he says, I was uncomfortable. You know, initially I was uncomfortable, but what it led me to think about was how women must feel all the time walking into these environments that are absolutely designed for men.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
blah, blah.
Steve, come on.
Maybe.
Come on.
Maybe if women walked into the health club men's locker room.
Steve, okay, come on. If you have an event that's very, let's say, in the financial industry's business or the computer electronics show, and there's a bar or a cigar lounge and it's leather and it's guys and there's... And you're a woman and you walk in, you know that wasn't designed for you.
Well, first of all, if you walk in, you're walking into a cocktail lounge where women go to. I mean, it's not,
but it's not for them. It really isn't for them.
If you go to a restaurant and the lounge is there, you don't think that's for men and women?
It's usually men being served by women waitstaff.
Really?
Scantily clad. Now,
where are these places?
Where would you like to give me some?
Right.
I'll give you some addresses.
These are not my recollections.
We'll post them online. But here's
my thing.
Yep.
So, you know, I read that piece where the guy walked in and his eyes, you know, the angel sang and all of this stuff. And, you know, these are professional women.
Yes.
If they are at this event,
oh, yeah.
they are powerful professional
yes.
women. and they're walking around with their hair in a towel.
Not in front of everyone, well, in the lounge.
But it's a professional situation.
I agree.
They talk about how they're having meetings in there and making contacts.
Is it any different than guys sitting around?
Walking around in towels in their locker room.
No, but what if they're at a sports event or they're at a golf and they're in shorts and a T-shirt? Okay, I really can't pull this off with a straight face because it's a mixed bag here. On the one hand, I applaud the concept of creating a more neutral environment, for sure would be a great idea.
Neutral, I'm with you.
Okay. Right. Or Virgin Hotel here in Chicago, which at least attempted to put women into the mix when they thought about the design.
Okay.
That I hear. Going so far out there to have women walking around with towels and having manicures being done, that's where I have a problem.
Yeah, because I don't think you, if, I don't want to say that the men are the enemy because they're not.
No.
Not even the adversary because they're not. But if you want to be on an equal playing field, you don't get there by playing their game with a different color.
Couldn't agree more.
And that's exactly what they're doing in the girls' lounge.
Couldn't agree more. And I also think that having women over to the side anywhere isn't helpful. However, let's just put credit in the concept itself. There's a real need at these conferences for environments to be created that are welcoming, that take into account the different needs of women and men from a visual point of view, food point of view, not just beer, not just, and I'm not trying to be stereotypical. I'm just saying let's open up the aperture of what these environments should look like. I don't think girls' lounge is the answer.
Would you give me a bagel?
A muffin?
A muffin. Would you give me a muffin?
Does everyone know this is Steve's and my code for, right, will you be subservient to me?
Right. And so, yeah, a poppy seed would be good. All right, let's talk about your money story, too. You know, last week we had on the CEO of Purse Strings. And it's, I'm sorry her name is escaping me now, but it's a cool idea that she goes around and teaches women about long-term investment. The idea is that women aren't as interested. Now, I'm not sure I buy all of that, but it is kind of a growing movement.
It's a growing movement because the facts are that women control $14 trillion of personal wealth in the United States. And there is evidence to show that they don't feel a lot of agency and empowerment when it comes to investing their money.
Right.
And women tend to equate money and math. And then there's a whole narrative around, are girls supposed to be good at math? And in many relationships, it's true that while the woman may take care of bill paying and sort of simple tasks, that the long-term strategic thinking is usually left to the guy.
That's funny you say that because that's kind of the way it is in my house. But I don't consider the monthly the short-term easy or the easy part. I consider that the arduous, difficult. Is this bill paid yet? Is this, you know, is the money there? Is the money here?
Is that
that's the hard part?
But
for
is
me.
That strategic?
No, but it's easy to have a quarterly meeting and say, well, let's adjust this in my 401k.
I guess, although the decisions you need to make about investing have bigger implications than the decision I have to make about, are we paying the dry cleaner's bill or the grocery bill?
Barbara Provost was the CEO of First
Choice. From Grays Lake.
All right, so you've got this money story.
So this is a fascinating tool, and I really recommend, I think you posted it, right?
I did. I put it on Twitter, and it's on my Facebook page, too.
So this is from The Daily Worth, which is a fantastic website about women and money, and it's www.moneytype.me, .com, .me. And it's one of those surveys, almost like a personality test that you can take. And it asks you questions that will lead to a conclusion about what is your relationship to money? What kind of a person are you? Do you spend? Do you save? Do you enjoy giving? Are you very materialistic?
How long does it take to go through this?
Oh, 4 minutes, really? 5 minutes. It's short. But what comes out the other side is an analysis of you. You know, it does an algorithm and comes up with, this is what we think, almost like not quite astrology, a whole lot more sophisticated than that.
Right.
And you have to look at that response, their analysis, and say, wow, what does that say about the way I behave relative to money? Which, as we all know, money's a piece of paper. It's what we impose on it. It's what we dream up when it's in our hands that really becomes the tricky part.
So did you do it?
Oh, I did.
And do I want to ask?
Well, I won't use the language of the survey until people take it, but I will say that here's what it said about me. I was typed as a visionary, which is somebody who believes my idea is so good that it is worth everybody paying me to do it.
Okay. So that's where the money part comes in.
Yeah. I believe that my idea will drive revenue, that my idea is in the lead, not the budget, not the P&L, not the practicalities, but the idea itself is so good that it's going to be the driver of getting money.
If you dream it, they will come.
If you dream it, they will come. And as you can imagine, there's a upside to that and a downside to that.
Right. I can imagine the downside. I can.
I'd love for you to take it.
I will.
And then let's talk about what your money type is.
We'll talk about that next week.
Yep.
Suzanne Muchen is the co-host of The Big Payoff. You can hear that at WGNplus.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I hope they serve her hamburgers, Orion. You're listening to the Wintrust.
Probably will.
No hot dogs for you, you cattle rustler. On the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Ian Scherer is on the phone line from CNET to talk about what's new in the world of tech. Ian, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, but I have to tell you, I am an Apple guy. I have a Mac computer, and one of the reasons is because there is no way, never, that my computer will be impacted by a virus. Until now.
Never
say never. Right. What's going on with this?
Well, so it turns out that there is a way to attack Macs. And of course, I mean, all software is written by human beings. Thus, it is fallible. And this is one of those instances where it's happened. A version of ransomware, which is where the computer gets taken over and basically held for ransom until you pay someone, has shown up in the wild, quote unquote, so it's on the internet somewhere. And some people found it. And actually, the way we helped find out about it was that researchers at Palo Alto Networks, which is a networking company, found it. And then Apple very quickly made sure that they were protected against it. And
so this isn't your run-of-the-mill. This isn't your run-of-the-mill virus. This is one of those where, these people have hit police departments and other things like that, hospitals, right? Where you have to pay them to disable the virus.
Right, that's the hard part, right, is that they actually take over your computer and you have to pay them to basically neutralize the problem. And so this one brought a $400 ransom note, which is pretty common, although it goes all over the place. But yes, there have been hospitals that have paid millions of dollars to try and kind of disable these types of things. And the worst part is that a lot of these things are done anonymously, and so the money ends up going God only knows where. And so in this instance, Apple appears to have protected your Mac already. Quietly, they sent over a little file to your computer you didn't know over the internet to protect you. But this is a great example of where, you know, even though you have a Mac, you still have to be thoughtful about where you're going and what websites you're going to. The same rules that apply for PCs apply generally for any computer. Don't go to websites that you think might be dangerous. Don't share your password with people you don't know. Be careful that when you click on a link, you know where it's going. All of those basic things, even though Apple has had a much better track record with hacking and with viruses, that doesn't mean it's perfectly safe. And that's the instance here.
Did you say this went through like a torrenting software site? I mean,
yeah. So the technology called torrenting is basically mostly used for illegal software downloads.
So like a movie and music
for good things, exactly. And so it was actually through a popular type of torrenting software is where this got taken from, and someone hacked into it, the software, and actually made when a software update was sent down to a lot of people who use it, it was included in there. It's a very kind of intricate way that they did it, but in the end, it was pretty bad. It affected quite a few people, and so it's a good reminder that especially when you're going to do kind of illicit things with your computer, you're going to make yourself vulnerable.
All right, so I want to talk, you know, one of the first times we talked about these, I don't know what you call them, I want to say online betting sites, but it's not, DraftKings and FanDuel. You know, we've got March Madness just around the corner, and Illinois is one of the states cracking down on these sites. It seems to me like it's online gambling. But here in Virginia, the governor, Terry McAuliffe, just signed a bill into law that makes these sites legal. Does this mean the tide is turning for them?
Well, it might be. It's very interesting. I think, you know, at one point, I don't know about you, I couldn't go anywhere without running across an ad for these DraftKings and FanDuel people.
I mean, weren't they in bed with ESPN? They were all over ESPN.
All over the place, and especially if you were a fan of the league, right? It was a big plot point in the show at one point. And so it's become a huge business. But then there was that all of that drama over the possibility of cheating inside of there. And it was a New York Times story, I believe it was, that broke the news that some of the employees had been cheating in the systems. And it turned into a huge thing. The government started cracking down, and suddenly all those ads disappeared. So now it appears that Virginia is allowing these things to exist. A lot of the question has been, how is betting legal on sports teams? And it comes down to these kind of very narrow discussions of law that are much more intricate than we can get into in 5 minutes. But what it turns into is that Virginia has said, okay, we're going to allow this to exist, which means that this may be a sign that the rest of the country is going to accept them. Although it's worth noting that stuff like slots, you know, for your apps and for your phones, there were a couple of states that started playing with allowing that to happen. But generally speaking, across the country, it's still not legal. You still can't bet on slots on your phone. You can't download an app and get money back if you win. And that's kind of could be where we go with this as well, is that Virginia allows it, but not too many other places.
Ian Scherer from CNET, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You bet. Bill and Wendy just around the corner.